for the late start. We're going to approach the agenda to accommodate a couple of people's schedule issues today as follows. We're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 2279. Then we'll move, we'll suspend that hearing after we have a little bit of testimony. We'll come back into it later, but we'll jump back up on the agenda to House Bill 2063 and then to House Bill 2269. And before we move into that bill, do we have, I think we have a couple of LCs, or at least one LC for measure introduction. Colleagues, in front of you is, this is a timely one for the insurance industry, who's all sitting out in the audience today on this thing. This is LC 2080, increases motor vehicle liability coverage required for personal injury and property damage.
This was my bill last session, wasn't it?
No.
I don't think it's the same. So, colleagues, the chair would entertain a motion that LC 2080 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objection?
So, Mr. Chair? Oh. They're just being so nervous back there. We ought to talk about it for a while.
All right. So, LC 2080 introduced as a committee bill. And now we'll move on and open a public hearing on House Bill 2279. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2279 was introduced at the request of the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary for the Oregon State Bar Alternative Dispute Resolution Section. Essentially, it amends the current Uniform Arbitration Act to enact the revised version of the act. The current version was adopted in 1955. Since that time, the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws has adopted revisions to the act, and this would bring the Oregon law in accord with those revisions. And the revised act has been approved by the American Bar Association and adopted by five states.
Thank you, counsel. We'll start with a presentation by James Damis of the Oregon State Bar, after which we'll ask Harlan Levy from the Oregon Association of Realtors to come testify. Harlan has I won't advertise all your business, Harlan, but an important doctor's appointment with a wife who is about ready to have a baby. So we're going to let him testify so he can make his family commitment on time. We'll then suspend the testimony on the bill and move on to the normal course of the agenda and then come back and pick our other witnesses up at the end. So, Mr. Damis, if you want to come forward, please.
Thank you, Chair Williams and members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is James J. Damis, and I'm here on behalf of the Executive Committee of the Alternative Dispute Resolution Section of the Oregon State Bar, which caused this bill to be introduced. As Mr. Joseph noted, the purpose of this bill is to substitute for the current Uniform Arbitration Act, a revised Uniform Arbitration Act. Because of the tremendous growth in the number of arbitrations that are occurring, the uniform commissioners felt it was time to have a revised act, primarily to do three things. One was to incorporate into the revised act the various decisions by courts that help clarify the rights and remedies that could exist under the Uniform Act. A second goal was to establish default provisions for how arbitrations should occur, the notices to parties, the procedures that were to be used, so that when the parties themselves simply said, we agree to arbitrate, but had not adopted their own rules for governing arbitrations, such as naming the American Arbitration Association or Arbitration Service of Portland or some other organization, they could look to the statute, which would give a broader procedure for what now exists. The current Uniform Act is just two pages in the Oregon revised statutes. It's pretty scanty. And the third reason for the revised act was to have in place certain provisions and rights that could not be waived by the parties. An example would be the right to have an attorney to represent you. And those were the purposes. One of the biggest changes, in our view, was what the revised act is now grants the authority to the arbitrator to allow discovery, to allow depositions of not only parties, but also non-parties, as well as discovery. And that's within the discretion of the arbitrator. And that's basically what the revised act does. It's going to be adopted in more and more states. And the executive committee urges its adoption here.
Thank you, Mr. Damas. I'll start with just a brief question. Do you know how many states have adopted the act at this point?
As of yesterday when I was told to be here, no. I didn't have time to look.
Okay. That may be a question that the bar can answer for us. Are there questions of Mr. Damas? We're going to have some other people testifying about this bill, colleagues. This is not a bill that we intend to take into work session, obviously, today, as we have an opportunity to address people's concerns about the Uniform Act. But it's a good time to ask questions if you have any.
I was expecting a question of this nature on behalf of the realtors. The realtors have established through the National Realtors Association a mechanism for resolving disputes among realtors about how to divide a real estate commission. And this has been resolved. They call it arbitration, and the realtors act as the arbitrators, and it's a quick and meant to be quick and summary fashion. A party has one of the realtors has the right to have an attorney, but discovery is not allowed. And the realtors have a concern that they're worried that this act would somehow upset or interfere with their arbitration mechanism that they've had in place for so long. And their concern is that if the realtor arbitrator denied a request for discovery, that some attorney would, on behalf of the denial, would use that to upset in court, to ask the court to vacate the award, to modify the award, or to correct the award on the basis of the denial of the arbitrator to grant discovery. And it's the position of the executive committee that a denial by a realtor arbitrator of discovery in these realtor against realtor commission disputes would not constitute grounds for a court to vacate, modify, or correct an award under sections 23 or 24 of the revised Uniform Arbitration Act.
All right. Well, if there aren't any direct questions, Mr. Damas, if you'd stay in there, we'll go ahead and have Harlan come up now.
Yes.
And we'll actually see what the realtors want. Representative Crummell, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually going to ask that question and wasn't sure if you were the appropriate person to ask or not, but since you brought it up, should there, and I understand what you're saying, so if there's, if that would not be a basis for a court under this statute to vacate a realtor-to-realtor commission dispute, is that something that should be laid out specifically in the statute, or is the language, is it your feeling that the language that's in here covers that well enough already?
We believe that there's no need to change the language of the revised Uniform Arbitration Act. The grounds that a court may use to vacate, modify, or correct award are listed in sections 23 and 24 of the Act. They're mm-hmm. very narrow, and it's our belief that the proper interpretation of those would not give a court grounds to vacate, modify, kind of the denial of a realtor arbitrator in these realtor to realtor dispute commission arbitrations.
Okay, if I may, Mr. Chair. I guess another question that kind of comes up then for me anyway is a matter of nomenclature. In a in an arbitration? Is it always or usually the case that both parties are represented by counsel? Or is it and that also the person that actually is the arbitrator is a lawyer as well?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, anybody under our law can act as arbitrator. There is no requirement of what it takes to be an arbitrator. I'm told in these realtor against realtor commission disputes that always the realtors act as arbitrators. If you're asking generally, in arbitrations generally, arbitrators are attorneys or retired judges and therefore familiar with the law and also running a procedure and discovery and so forth.
Okay.
Not required, but simply any time the stakes get large enough and people have to decide who they want as an arbitrator, then they're very finicky. And in addition to wanting someone who is bright and conscientious and civil and possesses common sense, they also want someone who has expertise in the underlying area of the law, which is really arbitration's biggest benefit.
Okay. I think I'm satisfied for now, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Crummell.
Thank you.
Mr. Levy.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Harlan Levy, staff attorney for the Oregon Association of Realtors. And yes, I do have a very important doctor's appointment to attend this afternoon.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
When's the baby due, Harlan?
Well, the baby is due on February 14th, but it looks like they're going to have the baby come on Monday. So.
Wow. So well, our best wishes to you and your wife.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Oh, getting back to the bill, I want to thank the previous speaker for going into our concern. We had talked about that previously, and I think he did an adequate job of explaining it to the committee. I also want to thank Representative Crummell for pursuing that line of questioning. The one thing I did want to bring to your attention is the experience that some of our realtor friends in Hawaii have had. Apparently, they adopted a similar revision to their arbitration statutes there, and their concern, which we share as well, is that arbitration is starting to look much more like litigation. And the whole purpose for having arbitration is because it's alternative dispute resolution to keep people and their lawyers out of court. The whole purpose is to be less expensive, take less time, be less time consuming, and make the process move a lot quicker. And we just hope that the committee keeps that in mind as it goes through this bill. I'm not here to testify on behalf or against this bill. Just want to caution you that the whole purpose of arbitration is to create an alternative to litigation and not create something that mirrors the litigation process with the discovery and the subpoena powers and all the other things that make litigation so expensive. With that, I will conclude my testimony and be happy to take any questions you might have.
Harlan, I've just got a question. And obviously, we're always interested if a state's gone ahead before us in adopting something to know a little bit about their experience. Have you sensed or have you gotten any information back from folks who are in your line of work in Hawaii that they've had a problem actually with this, where in these realtor-to-realtor disputes about commissions, that there has been a tendency to subpoena and do discovery and all that sort of stuff, or is it just the concern that could happen that's been driving their concerns?
Chair Williams, actually, I'm just getting this secondhand from my CEO who spoke with the Hawaii people today, so I don't have that information for you. I can go find that out, and when this bill comes back up, I'd be happy to report the specifics to that. for the committee.
And that would be something that I want you to obviously share with the folks at the bar who are bringing this bill forward, but even before we put the bill back up for hearing, because if we can know about any of those problems. It seemed to me to the extent that it said that an arbitrator may issue a subpoena, it certainly creates the possibility where an arbitrator could do it, but certainly under the vacating the award issue and the modification or correction of award, it leaves the discretion of the arbitrator, and so it wouldn't be a basis for overturning the award. But I certainly, you know, share your concern that to the extent it increases the litigation-like experience, in particularly in sort of small, well-defined arbitration issues like the one you've described, that's something that we ought to talk about.
We agree, Chair Williams.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Levy? Yes, go ahead, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, is the realtor's arbitration process binding or non-binding? Do you know?
I believe that it is binding, unless there is, similar provisions in it for vacating the award, you know, if there's bias or undue influence, but I believe that it is a binding process.
Is there any kind of review process at all? Or,
you know,
just the arbitration?
I'm not sure about that. I can look into that for the committee.
Representative McPherson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Levy, is the arbitration process limited solely to realtor versus realtor disputes, or does it extend to realtor and commission payer disputes as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, the process that we are alluding to is the process when two realtors have a dispute over a commission. But in every sales agreement, most of our members use a form document for their real estate sales agreements, and there is contained in that provision a requirement that the parties go to arbitration as well. So there are two different things that we're talking about here.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, yes, Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of following up on Representative McPherson a little bit. So if there were a dispute between a realtor and a client, specifically realtor and a seller, the seller is going to be paying the commission, and it states in the sales agreement that they will go to arbitration. Is this the type of arbitration that they would go to, or would it be an arbitration where there is another realtor hearing the case and making a determination?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, I believe that it is this type of arbitration they would go to. I believe that at least in the Portland region, the Portland Metropolitan Association has contracted with the arbitration people that Mr. Dumas represents. So this would be the governing of that type of arbitration.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much, Harlan.
Thank you,
again,
Mr. Chair.
Best of luck to you and your wife in this next week.
Thank you.
Okay, we are going to pause the hearing on House Bill 2279 and return to the normal order of the agenda to House Bill 2063 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2063. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2063 was also introduced at the request of the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary for the Oregon State Bar Estate Planning and Administrative Section. This measure seeks to replace the 1962 Uniform Principal and Income Act with the newer 1997 version of the Act. The current version of the Act, the 1962 version, does not address some of the crucial aspects of total return investing, nor certain modern business entities such as limited liability companies, mortgage-backed securities, and dividend reinvestment plans or tax-deferred retirement accounts. This new version of the Act would incorporate provisions with respect to each of those types of entities.
Okay. Thank you.
We have some witnesses here.
And we'll start out with Chris Klein. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, or afternoon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chris Klein. I'm an attorney practicing in Portland, Oregon, and I'm on the executive committee of the State Bar's Estate Planning and Administration section. We are proposing this legislation to do a couple of different things. First of all, it will update the Principal and Income Act to cover a number of types of investments that were not covered under the 62 Act, including, for example, timber, which oddly enough you would think would be covered in an Oregon Principal and Income Act, but is not. There are a number of other types of investments, deferred compensation plans, all kinds of things that are not currently covered under the existing Principal and Income Act. But perhaps the most important part of this legislation is the ability of a trustee to allocate between principal and income. And let me give you a brief example of why that's important. It's very common for people when they're creating a trust for their children or for whomever to provide that the current beneficiary, the person who's the beneficiary today, is entitled to the trust accounting income. And then when that person dies or upon a certain event taking place, the trust will terminate and the property will pass to a successor, perhaps the current beneficiary's children or something. The problem is that if you define the current beneficiary's rights by their income, you are limited to what is defined as income under the Act, under the Principal and Income Act. And that includes rents, royalties, interests, and dividends, but does not include, for example, capital gains. So if you sell Microsoft stock, which has been growing and has not thrown off any dividends, that capital gain has to be put back in as principal, and the current beneficiary is not entitled to that property. This has created a problem for three reasons. First of all, in 1995, Oregon passed the Prudent Investor Act, which says that you have to invest prudently, hence the title. But it also looks at a total return of investment, that is, growth of the principal plus income return, so that you no longer just look at what the property is throwing off. You look at how much it's growing. The other problem, of course, was the rapid growth of stocks, at least in the 90s, not today, where the growth of these stocks was not being was not benefiting a current beneficiary under that income-only approach. It would only benefit the remainder beneficiaries. And then finally, we have a very low interest rate currently, which just sort of goes to exacerbate the problem even further. What this new act will do is that it will allow you to reallocate principal as income in order to increase the amount of distributions to the current beneficiary so that you don't have this inherent tension in the investment strategy. You can simply invest for total growth and total return. Either, you know, you can balance your portfolio, and you don't care what the return is considered for principal and income act purposes, because if you don't have enough income, you can simply reallocate. There are a number of safeguards in the bill that prevent the trustee from allocating inappropriately, including there are a number of types of trustees that cannot exercise this power. If, for example, I was the beneficiary of a trust and also the trustee, I would not be able to reallocate to myself. So there are a number of safeguards built into this allocation power, but that is the main change from existing law, apart from the further definition of what is income and what is principal.
Everybody get that? Are there committee questions?
John, right here.
Okay, we were hoping you were going to, with Shetterly out of the room, we were sort of looking to you, Greg, to sort of step in on this one and lead the charge.
Let me help form a better understanding, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, feel free.
Although I would have to say, as a premise, that I this is actually is a little outside of my area, but could you generalize about the sort of the nature of those latter set of changes about that is a is there a general theme to the changes with respect to principal and income allocation differences that you were just describing?
Could I insert, because I think it would be helpful for the committee maybe to even take a step back and Chris, if you could maybe even just describe generally why we had an original Principal and Income Act.
Certainly.
What its purpose is with respect to trust accounts and trust relationships, and then answer Greg's question about the impact of those changes.
Sure. The reason you have a principal and income act is that there are rights under a trust agreement that are defined in terms of those words. That is, you have a right to income. The minute I say, as a lawyer in a trust, that a person has a right to income, I have to have a place to find out what income is. And there's a difference between trust accounting income, that is, the income that's defined under Oregon state law, and taxable income, for example. One example that I gave was the example of capital gains. If I sell a highly appreciated stock so that I can diversify and buy a bunch of different stocks, that sale will generate taxable income in the form of capital gains, but it is not income for trust accounting purposes under Oregon state law. So although I would have to pay tax on the sale, I would not be able to distribute that money to the beneficiary. So you have this kind of bifurcation of terms, where income for tax purposes means one thing, but income for my trust agreement means something else. And whenever you say it in a trust agreement, you have to look to the statute, not to tax law, for example. So the definition of what is income and what is principal is critical for any trust agreement that says you're entitled to income, because that's where I have to look. I have to look to the state statute.
And the reason, Chris, that we regulate this area is...
You know, the reason we regulate this area is because 500 years ago in England, they decided to do it that way, and we've just never changed the system. I wish I had a better rationale for you, but this is a practice that has existed forever. You know, the theory that you give away income from a property, it probably originated, you know, back when everybody owned farms, and that was what people's wealth was.
But it's also to ensure that the people who are sort of managing the assets of the trust are manage them in an appropriate way. Isn't that right?
Correct, although we have a disconnect now in that, right? Because, again, you have a tension between wanting to invest to benefit a current beneficiary and therefore produce as much income as possible, for example, by buying bonds. That would throw off interest, and therefore all that interest would be income for trust accounting purposes and would go to the current beneficiary. On the other hand, if you went and invested in high-growth, low-yield stocks, that growth would all benefit the remainder beneficiaries, and the current beneficiary wouldn't have any income, because even if you sold the stock, it would simply be a return of principal, and you just reinvest it. So you have this tension for a trustee to decide, well, am I going to benefit this person over here by generating income, or am I going to benefit this person over here by pursuing a growth strategy? And if I do one, I'm violating my duty to the other. And it's, in a way, an irreconcilable difference. And being able to move between the two, to allocate income as principal, or principal as income, rather, allows you to avoid that problem. It allows you to invest for the overall return with some kind of blend, you know, maybe 60-40 stocks and bonds, just to pick an example, without worrying, if you decide that that's the appropriate strategy, without worrying about who you're benefiting from that investment.
You want to follow up now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for helping us build the background here. It sounds as though there's updating going on with respect to bringing new asset classes, or maybe even old asset classes that weren't addressed in the law before. But is there, return to the question I was asking before, could you generalize about, is it just tinkering, or is there a slant to the way that these new provisions work under the Uniform Act? That is, does it tend to enhance the flow of income? Does it tend to retain more in corpus, or is it all over the map?
In general, I think it's fairly neutral. That is, a number of those investments that were not defined, where timber, for example, or a deferred compensation plan or a retirement plan or something, where we didn't have a definition of what was income and what was principal, they've just sort of assigned an arbitrary 10% number. That is, 10% of the overall return that you get we're going to deem to be income, and the rest will be principal. Mm-hmm. They've done that, I think, to define a bright line so that people can tell more easily which is which. But when you look at it in conjunction with the allocation power, all bets are off. You can readjust that to suit the needs of the beneficiaries that you have at, you know, in your particular case. So I think that the overall theme is fairly neutral, but it is somewhat arbitrary in that they've picked this 10% number in a number of different places in the Act, with the idea that if that doesn't work for you, you can always change it.
And what's the excuse me, Mr.
Yes,
Chair?
Please.
And what's the sort of history of the development of these changes in the Uniform Act? That is, it how recently have these revisions come about, and how and what kind of broad how broadly used are they?
They've come about fairly recently, and it's largely in response to this Prudent Investor Act that I discussed earlier that Oregon adopted in '95. That is, with the mandate to go out and invest for total return. A number of trustees, banks, and individuals were coming back and saying, we can't invest for total return without either harming one beneficiary or the other. So we need some kind of a device to not only invest under this Prudent Investor Act, but also to treat both beneficiaries fairly. And this was essentially the response from the uniform law folks. It has been adopted in... And I also was called yesterday afternoon, so I didn't have a chance to look at that information either. But I want to say in about 20 states it's been adopted, but it's also there's a lot of buzz about it, and I think we'll see a lot more states adopting it. So there is something of a groundswell for this.
Thank you very much, Representative McPherson. And Chris, can you tell us, is this... wholesale the uniform law, I mean, essentially, or are there some particular changes that were specific to Oregon that have already been addressed in the draft that's in front of us?
There is, in my testimony, I mentioned the fact that you have the option of converting to a uni trust. That's actually not in this piece of legislation. It was originally there, and I think LC's office removed it so that it could be put someplace else. Okay. And that may be the subject of subsequent legislation. That was the major change. It was that one piece. And since we've taken it out, there's really very little other than conforming changes to match the Oregon style of drafting. Mm-hmm. This is essentially the Uniform Act. Mm-hmm.
Are there further questions? You guys are all too chicken to ask him anything, aren't you?
I love doing the geeky estate planning legislation.
Yeah, right. Well, like I said, our estate planning legislator, Representative Shetterly, for whatever reason, picked this moment to be out of the hearing room. So you're probably going to get off easy with some questions that he would have had for you. I think we're going to go ahead then. Chris, if you'd stay at the dais,
sure.
I'd like to invite... our next witness is Brad Swank from the courts. Brad, if you want to come forward.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank, Special Counsel for Government Relations for the State Court Administrator's Office. I'm here today because a concern was raised this morning to me concerning this bill. And I haven't had a chance to fully analyze it, but I'll explain it to you in the way that it was presented to me. It centers primarily around Section 4A, which I've had a very brief chance to look at and would like a chance for office to look at more. But the specific concern that was raised to me this morning focuses on subsection 4 of Section 4A, which is on page 4 of the bill. It's a lot of 4s. Anyway, it says, upon petition by the fiduciary, a court having jurisdiction over a trust or estate shall determine whether a proposed exercise or non-exercise by the fiduciary of discretionary power conferred by Sections 1 to 31 of this Act will result in an abuse of the fiduciary's discretion. As the chair is well aware, and I guess as this is my opportunity to explain to you that's sort of a traditional concern of the courts, Oregon courts are not allowed under the Oregon Constitution to give advisory opinions. And in this instance, it's a petition by a fiduciary for the court to determine whether a proposed exercise or non-exercise would breach their power. That would be pretty much an advisory opinion. A case that I can give to cite to you for your record on this issue is Brown versus the Oregon State Bar, at 293 Oregon 446. That's a 1982 case, one of a number of cases going back in a line of cases to at least 1938, where the Supreme Court held that Oregon courts can't, you know, you can't rush into an Oregon court and say, well, if we did this, would it be a problem? And they said that there has to be an actual case or controversy, and that's a constitutional issue in this state. So that is an issue we had. And I did talk to the bar, previous presenter earlier, to let them know. As I say, this issue was brought to me this morning. I came over, I looked at the bill, came over, and we talked to the bar about our concern. There may be some way to draft around it, because I think what they're looking for is an opportunity under certain circumstances to go to the court for instructions. And I'm not sure how all that works through, but I thought I would raise the issue to you, because it's an issue that crops up from time to time, and let you know why we're concerned about it. And I guess in this instance, my fear would be that somebody would go to a court, and the court would go, "I'm sorry, we can't do that."
Brad, let me ask you about that, because I mean, wouldn't this essentially be in the form of a declaratory judgment action? I mean,
well, and that's the reason I cited the Brown versus Oregon State Bar case, because that was actually under the Oregon Declaratory Judgments Act. And the court said, you know, you can't, there has to still be a controversy there, even for declaratory judgment, that the court can't give an advisory opinion. And it's an issue. In this instance, I think the way that it's stated, that, you know, it's a proposed action, I think pretty fairly makes it advisory. Like I said, there may be some way to draft around it, and I haven't thought it through all the way, but I got this morning.
Mr. Coyne?
Yeah, and we discussed this briefly, and my thoughts are preliminary, but we already have the authority to go into court with any trust matter and request instructions from the court. That is, I'm about to do something, and I hope it's okay, and please tell me it is, and then as soon as the court grants you the order, you go ahead and undertake that action. And I think we could cast the act of discretion as a petition for instructions. Indeed, we might move this section, just thinking off the top of my head, move this section over to the section that deals with the petition for instructions and place it there. I'm not sure the extent to which our statute actually runs afoul of that case, but I don't think it does. I think that we have the authority, and it's really just a question of fixing the drafting so that it stays on the straight and narrow.
Yeah, it does seem to me that there's always been sort of a different rule with respect to matters like trust matters, where the court sort of stands as the ultimate protector of the beneficiaries of the trust. Okay, well, that's an issue, obviously, we're going to want to hear more about. Questions? All right. Mr. Martinez? Thanks, Brad.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Tim Martinez here today representing the Oregon Bankers Association. I'm very hopeful that your committee will stay chicken and not ask me any questions either. But if we do, I do have two certified smart people behind me who can talk trust law with the best of them. We do appreciate the bar. The bar did bring this to the Oregon Bankers Association. We have a joint meeting last year. We've had it under consideration. We've looked at it. We now actually obviously have the final bill, and as you indicated, there were some changes made in legislative council. But I can tell you one of the most exciting part of my jobs is once a month meeting with 13 trust lawyers and going over the nuances of these bills. At the end of the day this week, I think it was Monday or Tuesday we met, and we had I wasn't sure whether we were a OBA committee or whether we were a committee of aliens, because we were up to about 13 different hands. You know, we started out, well, on this hand, on the other hand, and 13 hands later, it's unclear where my trust committee is on this piece of legislation. I would humbly request of the committee that you let us continue to discuss this with the bar and internally, and I can assure you that we can get you an answer promptly. We did have one member of our committee, Mary Chapin, I believe, was actively involved in the drafting of this. She is extremely comfortable with the legislation and would also like the opportunity to continue to work with her colleagues in banks and trust companies, because I think we're the biggest impact it comes to us as far as what happens down the road.
Thank you, Mr. Martinez. For I I've asked everybody who's got concerns about any of this legislation, even if their organization hasn't taken a firm position yet, to at least come up and make the committee aware of concerns that they have about the bill. I think it's only helpful in facilitating both an awareness on our part of what the issues are and an awareness among the proponents of the bill as to what they need to potentially do to satisfy people's concerns. So I appreciate you coming up, Tim. Now, to the extent that this is a uniform laws bill, I would assume that somewhere back in the ivory tower of the uniform laws operation that they thought about having at least a couple of bankers around to talk about that. I mean, are you sensing what maybe is the issue here is that you've just got some people who haven't spent much time with this as it's gotten developed, but the fact that it's maybe been adopted in 20 other states and they have an opportunity to work with their colleagues in out-of-state operations would maybe satisfy some of those concerns?
Well, Mr. Chairman, as you know, myself and folks that do the same thing I do sometimes love uniformity and other times find reasons not to be quite so supportive. We have looked at, like I say, I think there is certain number of my members of the Trust Committee are very comfortable with it. One of the concerns that I do think is out there from a trust business or a bank trust business is the question of liability. You know, where, you know, what this act seems to say at times is that, you know, go ahead and take your best shot at it. Maybe it's 100% in Microsoft. And historically, that's not how trust companies have worked. You know, they try to do a balanced approach and try to spread it around and not really look for, you know, the top dollar. As was mentioned, you know, in 95, we did participate in the Prudent Investor Act, which kind of directs us in that direction as well. So I think there is a comfort factor involved. The fact that 20 states have done it is important, but I would just point to last session when we did Uniform Commercial Code Article 9, where what came out of Oregon was not exactly what the rest of the country had adopted.
Any other questions? Thank you both very much. is there anyone else here to testify on this bill? House Bill 2063. Okay, hearing none, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2063. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2269. Counsel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 2269 was also introduced, the request of the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary for the Oregon State Bar, the State Planning Administrative Section. It amends Oregon law to make the provisions that are applicable to the use of revocable trusts consistent with the provisions applicable to wills with respect to gifting, inheritance, effective divorce, and related issues. Specifically, revocable trusts have become more popular as a substitute for wills. However, they do not have many of the protections, specifically drafting protections and beneficiary protections that wills do. This measure would make those protections applicable to both revocable trusts and wills.
Thank you, counsel. And once again, Mr. Klein.
My name is still Chris Klein, and this one's easier than the last one. I think that summary just about says it all. There are a number of provisions for wills that are different than those for revocable trusts, and yet the revocable trusts are becoming more and more popular as a will substitute. Many people are not executing wills anymore. They're executing revocable living trusts to avoid probate and help for incapacity planning. This bill will, its primary purpose is to harmonize the laws of trusts to make them more like the law of wills that we've had for quite some time, so that there's some common ground with them. There's also a couple of cleanup provisions, if you will, that allows trusts that are improperly drafted to be fixed, essentially, and qualify for the marital deduction. That's one that's not a harmonization statute per se, but the bulk of the statute simply allows the law of trusts to be more in compliance with the law of wills. And I've got some examples if you'd like me to go through them.
Oh, I think we would.
Yeah. The first is that gifts to a former spouse under a will are automatically revoked upon divorce. So that if I draft a will for a client and the client leaves everything to her husband and they subsequently get divorced, all those gifts to the husband are automatically revoked. That's not the case in irrevocable trust, but it would be the case now with this legislation. Gifts that pass to a relative under a will, if that relative predeceases the testator, then that gift does not lapse, but rather goes to the relative's children. So, for example, if I leave a gift to my brother in my will and he dies before I do, then my gift in my will goes to his kids. Under a trust agreement, however, the gift simply lapses. So this legislation would conform the trust law to the will law and put in that anti-lapse provision. Afterborn children who are excluded from a will are re-included under statute. That is, a share of the estate that otherwise wouldn't pass to them because they weren't named does pass to them for wills, but not for trusts. And this would make that it would include those afterborn children provisions for trusts as well. Finally, there's a rather arcane body of law dealing with what happens when a gift, let's say I leave $10,000 to my brother and then I write him a check for $10,000. Was my check that I wrote to him in satisfaction of the gift in my will or not? I won't bother you with the details of exactly how they work, but those same provisions that we've had for years in wills are now going to be moved over to trusts as well, so that they are consistent. I mean, I'm happy to give you the details, but given the way the Prudent Investor Act or the Principal Income Act went, I'm hesitant. So those are sort of the highlights, and that's really the substance of the changes. Those 5 points.
Chris, can you give the committee a little background on the process that the committee went through in preparing this bill draft?
Absolutely. This has been a work in process for at least 5 years, with lawyers saying, hey, how come the laws for trusts are not the same as wills, even though they're acting as testamentary instruments in either case? And so we went back and forth on looking at some of these provisions that were in wills and saying, well, should we just take them out of wills and trusts, or should we simply make the law of wills applicable to trusts in all cases, and how do we define a trust? And we sort of went on and on and on about this. What we ultimately decided was to make the revocable trust look more like wills, simply because the body of law for wills has been around for so long, rather than tipping the apple cart and making policy changes that would change the law of inheritance under wills. We just decided to conform trusts to that so that we'd be more consistent with historical will treatment.
And again, let me ask you this question, Chris. Isn't it true that by and large that this is a sort of a gap filler provision in the law, to the extent that the revocable trust doesn't specifically say something else? In other words,
absolutely.
I am aware that I had an afterborn child, but I don't want, or any other thing that is specifically explained. This simply comes back in and says, if it's silent as to these operations, then this is the body of law and this is the way it's going to work out. If it's not silent to it and it's specific, then the language of the trust prevails over what the statute points to.
Right. This is paternalistic legislation. If you have left a hole in your document and didn't cover a certain point, these laws will fill in the blanks, just as they have for years in the context of wills.
Right.
Right.
Mr. Chair? Yes, Representative McPherson.
I think it might be helpful for the benefit of the committee to get a little sort of broader background about revocable trusts and the role that they play in estate planning, the emerging and increasing role they play, so that the committee would have an understanding about the significance of the changes that are being made.
Absolutely. Both wills and trusts have been around forever, but starting in the I want to say the early 70s, there was with a book called How to Avoid Probate, there has been a growing interest in using revocable trusts instead of wills. And what a trust is simply a contract between the trustee who holds title to the property, the person who creates the trust, and the person for whom the trust is created, the beneficiary. When you create a revocable living trust, you are all three of those people. So you simply take title to all of your assets and you transfer them to your own name as trustee. What that means is that when you die or when you become incapacitated, title automatically goes to the successor trustee. So if it's your spouse or your kids or whomever you want to name, you no longer have title to the assets. So that means that there's nothing to go through probate, which can be a very time-consuming and expensive process. And there is always someone available to take title to your assets and manage them for your benefit if you were becoming incapacitated. Alzheimer's, you know, sort of the stereotypical example. Because of those benefits, revocable trusts have been used more and more over the last 30 years. You cannot open a newspaper without one of those flyers for a seminar about revocable living trust falling out in your lap. They are becoming perhaps overused. I think that the number of the courts, the number of the probate court judges that I've talked to have said that, you know, the litigation surrounding trusts is in fact increasing because of the increase in their use. What that says to me is that we need to have at least some uniformity in terms of how words are used for all testamentary instruments, and that's what this bill hopes to do, is to bring some of that uniformity to the trust world.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative McPherson.
The last two bills we considered involved uniform acts, but the law of wills having been around for so long, was there ever a uniform statute that our law of wills in Oregon was derived from, or are we dealing with something that was essentially goes back to statehood and has evolved on its own?
It goes back to statehood. There is what's called a uniform probate code that Oregon has cribbed some pieces from but has not adopted in bulk. I hate to spoil the punchline, but in 2005, I think we're looking at the uniform trust code and to see what, if anything, in that piece of that's a fairly new uniform act, and we may choose to adopt some, all, or none of it. So the acts are out there, but currently Oregon has not adopted them. There are a number of fairly controversial provisions in the Uniform Probate Code that many states have chosen not to adopt. Whether that kind of treatment exists in the Uniform Trust Code, I don't know yet. We haven't really looked at it. But to date, this is simply an extension of the way Oregon law has been cribbed together over the years. Yeah.
Any additional questions for Mr. Kwan?
Mr. Chair, we got a little tutorial at our last meeting from Representative Shetterly about the difference between predeceasing and disclaiming and the legal effects of them under the bill we were considering the other day under insurance and other vehicles. And with your permission, I'll spare us a question on that change, which has its parallel in this statute.
Thank you very much, Representative. Did you all get that?
That means we're moving on. I have one other. Representative Shetterly, before he left, did ask me for the committee to consider whether this legislation ought to be given emergency status so that it becomes effective right away. You know, the executive committee's been working on it for so darn long that just getting to this dais is quite an accomplishment. But if that is something that the committee would feel is appropriate, he felt that it would be.
Okay. Any comments on that, colleagues? Late breaking news. This just in. Okay. All right. This is a note suggesting that Representative Shetterly thought it would be appropriate to add an emergency clause. Like breaking news. So with that, I think what we'll do, and we appreciate your testimony and you helping us get educated about the bill, Chris, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2269. We'll go ahead and ask counsel to at least draft the emergency clause and bring it back to us. At that time, we'll give Representative Shetterly an opportunity to talk to us a bit more further about that. So thank you very much. That then brings us back, colleagues, to the hearing on House Bill 2279, which I will now reopen. You'll recall this is the Uniform Arbitration Act, and we have heard from Mr. Damas representing the Alternative Dispute Resolution section of the Oregon State Bar, and then from Mr. Levy from the Realtors. Our next two witnesses, Steve Morrell and Sean Miller. Thank you. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Representative Chairman Williams and members of the committee. I will apologize in advance for the informal manner in which I'm dressed today. I've already apologized to Chair Williams. I did not anticipate being here today and came on relatively short notice. With respect to the adoption of the Revised Uniform Arbitration Act, we have a very narrow issue, and so I'll be very brief in that respect. At this time, we've looked at this bill and are evaluating it. I really don't have a position. I think I marked on my testimony that I was against with a question mark because actually our official position is we are neutral. We are concerned with Section 21 of the Act. That section allows an arbitrator to award attorney's fees and punitive damages if they're available in a civil action on a similar type of claim that's presented to him. We're concerned somewhat with how that interplays with Oregon law on those two issues, and like I say, we're evaluating and don't have a necessarily a position on it, but at the invitation of Chairman Williams, wanted to go on the record as having that concern in the event the bill comes back up, and we want to talk about that further. That's all I have for my testimony, unless any of you had questions on that matter.
Thanks, Steve. We'll let Sean talk, and then we'll have questions. Mr. Miller?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the National Association of Independent Insurers, which is an association of property and casualty insurance companies that do business here in Oregon. To preface my remarks, I will say that many of the insurance companies that I represent include arbitration clauses in their insurance contracts. Because arbitration does provide an efficient, speedy, and cost-effective method for resolving disputes. I think the concern that you've just heard, again, we don't have an official position on the bill because we have been evaluating how this deals with our contracts, but it does deal with on page 8, section 28. And if you look at that particular provision, it does talk about awarding, and it does say may allow an arbitrator to award punitive damages. And again, it's the same parallel of an issue that you just heard when you first heard this and how this relates to arbitration versus litigation. I think we do believe that, you know, punitive damages in the court system is appropriate. We're evaluating how appropriate punitive damages and how they are awarded in respect to giving the authority to a private arbitrator. And I know it's a concern. You've heard that this has been addressed in many of the other states. It is a uniform act. I know in other states they've had the same concern, and they've actually removed this particular provision of the law of punitive damages in some of those states that have adopted this law. But again, Mr. Chair, we've had a conversation earlier today, and our laws, every laws are different in every state. And so we need to be, we want to evaluate how this interrelates to the civil action, the ability to award punitive damages in these dispute resolutions, alternative dispute resolutions. I know the chair of the committee has experience in that, and I think we just want to have an opportunity to evaluate how that interacts with our current contractual relationships with our clients. And so that, you've heard our concern, and again, it's dealing with the punitive damages portion, Section 21 of the bill, and we'd be happy to work with the committee as this bill moves forward, but we want to look at this very close. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Questions? Representative Barker, did you have a question?
I didn't know who they were, who they were representing, the insurance companies.
And I apologize for that. After I did that and Mr. Miller started talking, I realized I was looking here at the sign that says, please identify yourself. I'm Steve Merle. I'm an attorney employed by State Farm Insurance, and I represent State Farm Insurance Companies.
Thank you. Yeah, and State Farm is one of the good hands. My insurance company that
No. I'm a good neighbor.
He's a good neighbor. His hands are horrible, but he's a great neighbor.
The insurance company I'm dealing with has one finger for me. I'm not having a lot of trouble with that. So I need this system here. Thank you. Prudential.
Here we go. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Prozanski. You had a question.
I did. When you're reviewing it, I'm wondering if you would be so kind to look at it in the perspective that if you're entering into contracts that require mandatory arbitration, whether or not you think it would be appropriate to allow for punitive damages to be awarded in that context, as compared to someone having the ability to potentially go into a judicial proceeding and bypassing arbitration.
Yes, Representative, that is a very good point. Actually, we we do have some of a narrow pool because looking at our agreements already have arbitration provisions in them, and we understand there is a broader picture to be concerned with.
Thank you.
Yeah, and that's the issue that I raised with Mr. Miller earlier today. To the extent that you've got mandatory binding arbitration in sort of pre-printed contracts where one could argue that perhaps the bargaining power of the nature of the contract might not be equal. In other words, if I want to buy your product, I have to sign these contracts, and the person who's selling me the product isn't at liberty to say, well, we can scratch out the arbitration clause and I'll still sell you the product, because they typically aren't going to have that authority from their home office. That sort of unequal bargaining power that then mandates somebody into a binding arbitration situation and then it takes away an opportunity perhaps to seek punitive damages is an issue that I think at least we need to address and have a conversation about in this committee, because I think there is a significant issue there that to the extent that there is a either side can choose to arbitrate but they don't have to kind of a provision in a contract, I think that's a different situation, one where you might very well say that's fine, but if you know you choose to arbitrate and both sides agree to arbitrate, you're walking away from your opportunity for punitive damages in that situation. Where it's a equal power bargained relationship, I think that's just a different situation. So that's the issue that I think at least the discussion about Section 21 at least raises, and I know you'll have a chance to talk to your clients a little bit about that and would be interested to know what other states have done as well on that subject. Any other comments? Yes, Representative Ackerman.
Question. At the conclusion of the arbitration proceeding, an award is issued by the arbitrator, then ultimately that award is confirmed by the court. Is that how I read the structure here?
Representative Ackerman, my experience with arbitration is that is an option to have it confirmed by the court and then entered as a judgment. As a practical matter, most of the arbitrations I've been involved with is the party who owes somebody something just sends a check in exchange for a release, and the court never gets involved. Okay. But the statute that's in front of you does allow that as an option. I think that's available under current law also.
I have a second follow-up question on that. I wanted to understand that if an award is confirmed by the court, would it be in the form of a judgment that which would be enforceable rather than just an order?
Representative Ackerman, that is my understanding. You can form it, and you're able to enter it as a judgment and execute using judicial authority to execute the judgment like any other judgment you would obtain.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Davis, do you want to come up and address any of the points that were raised? I wanted to give you that opportunity since we sort of bifurcated the hearing, and it might be instructive to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Williams. Punitive damages in Oregon are now allowed. Arbitrators can award punitive damages. But one of the biggest complaints about arbitration is that in this overbearing situation, contracts adhesion in which it says punitive damages cannot be allowed. That's really a separate, it doesn't have to be in the arbitration clause. Sometimes they put it in the arbitration clause, but the goal is, as the U.S. Supreme Court says, in consistently upholding arbitration under the Federal Arbitration Act, which preempts states. States cannot can't change, take away from the right of parties to arbitrate. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that a party gives up no substantive rights. Instead, they're simply deciding that those will be resolved in an arbitrable as opposed to a judicial forum. And taking away the right to punitive damages is, the courts don't like that. They will say that's unfair, and then they'll tend to throw the arbitration clause out instead of just excising that part of it because, especially in contracts of adhesion, you're taking away a party's substantive right. And so I'm sure that's why this was simply part of a codification by the Revised Uniform Act to do what courts have done and say that arbitrators inherently have the power to award punitive damages. Only in the state of New York were arbitrators denied that right, but New York's already corrected that. And the point earlier about the right to award attorney's fees, I think the goal there clearly is that if it's under contract law, if the parties by contract says attorney's fees can be awarded, or if a statute upon which the claim is based grants the right to attorney's fees, then in that case the arbitrator has the right to grant attorney's fees. I think that's their aim there.
Right. Thank you. Any other questions? Appreciate all three of you testifying and informing the committee, and I'd encourage you to work with your interest groups and get back to us and communicate with counsel. Our last witness on this bill is Brad Swank from the courts.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, once again, my name is Brad Swank, I'm the State Court Administrator's Office, Special Counsel for Government Relations. This is another bill that was brought to me this morning with some concerns that we thought it would help the committee if we mentioned them to them. One of the things that we do as part of our work is prepare fiscal impact statements on bills about which things are going to cost money and how much they're going to cost. And we were asked to do that late yesterday afternoon, hadn't finished because of some of the issues we've been looking through here. In general, an initial impression of mine this morning after reading the bill was that, to begin with, one of the things that the bill provides is greater court supervision of arbitrations, earlier involvement in arbitrations, and potentially the ability of people to run back and forth between court and the arbitrator while the arbitrator is doing the arbitrator's business. The normal model for arbitration in Oregon has generally been that they do the arbitration. If they don't like it, they go to court. In this instance, it appears, and like I said, this is an initial impression, and we've talked to the earlier presenters and are willing to sit down with them and work through it, but it appears that they can go to the arbitrator on, for instance, on page 6. It's if the arbitrator isn't moving along fast enough, you can go to court and get a court order to have the arbitrator move along. In section 18 on page 7, the judicial enforcement of pre-award rulings by arbitrators. So before the arbitrator's finished, if they want to go to the court, they can pick up the police power of the state by going to the court at that point. There's also a very strange procedure in here in which you get a and this is something that Representative Ackerman was alluding to earlier, in which they get an order and then they get a judgment on the order. And as most of you know who practice in Oregon or been on this committee around for more, mostly courts resolve things by judgments, and that's the way we want to have them resolved, and it makes them appealable, and it gives you a single piece of paper that you can sort of walk out and you go, okay, now I can appeal this, I can accept it, I can whatever I'm going to do with it. One concern that we had was by requiring this order and then judgment process, first of all, you double the amount of paper that's necessary, and then when you get to Section 28, you appear to give, at least in some instances, people the opportunity to appeal both the order and the judgment that results from the order. So it appears to give people two bites of the apple on an appeal. One of the things that you will hear from me, and I hope I don't become a pedant on it, is that things that courts do cost money. And that's an issue. And in this instance, there appears to be double the paperwork, double the appeals, and some other questions. One of them is, when I looked at 28, I mean, the bill not only works on the procedure, but one of the things that it appears to do is to limit the ability of the court to review the arbitration decision after it's been decided. When you look at sections 23 and some of the other, the number of grounds that a court can review on has an ability to review are limited, and so it might make it harder to challenge, which is a policy decision. But then when you get to section 28, I'm not exactly sure what the standard of review on appeal is, because you're appealing a limited decision by the court on which the court's discretion has been limited, and then we have no indication at all of what the appeals court is going to be particularly reviewing for. And the interesting thing is, and I just, if you look at section 14, which is
the immunity of the arbitrator, subsection 4 on page 5, in a judicial, administrative, or similar proceeding, an arbitrator, representative, and arbitration organization is not competent to testify, may not be required to produce records as to any statement, conduct, decision, ruling occurring during the arbitration proceeding, which is reasonably standard. But if you've got a situation where, in most instances, the court, the circuit court that you're going to first doesn't have much discretion, they're not going to generate much record. So if you appeal to the Court of Appeals on a proceeding that didn't have much record, what is the Court of Appeals going to be dealing with? Because they can't get the records from the arbitrator about what the arbitrator did. But these are questions that we had about this piece of legislation. As I say, I've talked to the bar. We are concerned that some of them potentially create costs for courts in these times when courts don't have a whole lot of revenue. We have been avid promoters of alternative dispute resolution since the late 80s. In our courts, we have court mandatory court annexed arbitration for our courts. We've started mediation programs virtually every court has. This one has some issues in it that we would like an opportunity to sit down with Bar and talk about.
Brad, I want you to be really specific with me about where you think there are costs for the courts related to this bill.
One of them, I think, and like I said, I've just had a chance to review this morning. The first issue that's a potential cost is the potential for increased supervision of the arbitration by the courts. The fact that you can get additional hearings after the arbitration starts, and you've got an ability of the arbitrator to somebody to run from the arbitration to the court to enforce a pre. Now I pointed that out before. A pre-award ruling. So you run to the judge and get that. Another one is, you know, the kind of thing that I mentioned on page 6, where you've got the court directing the arbitrator to conduct a hearing properly and render a timely decision.
Brad, I guess I'd just say that in my mind, while those might be new statutory language, I'm not sure that those are actually new powers or new opportunities being granted. I mean, to the extent that I'm in an arbitration proceeding, in fact, oftentimes what happens in the cases that I'm involved with that involve arbitration is one side sues and the other side points out that there's a contractual provision that requires arbitration and moves to compel arbitration. So there's a hearing in front of the judge. The judge looks at the contract and says, you can't be in front of me. This matter goes to arbitration. Now, usually the case stays open and is put into some sort of an abatement while the arbitration is pending. And if we get in front of an arbitrator who all of a sudden is dilettante in their responsibility to actually prosecute the case with the parties for some reason, there is nothing that prohibits us from turning right back around and going back in front of the judge and saying, Judge, we have a problem. You know, we can't agree on the arbitrator, and the arbitration contract doesn't say what we're supposed to do, or we can't get the arbitrator to actually set a date for a hearing, or any number of things that we can walk back in front of the judge and get the judge to actually issue an order in those cases as to what ought to happen. So I guess I'm less concerned about some of the codification of powers that already currently exist in my mind and are regularly used by practitioners as to how to manage and prosecute these arbitrations.
Chair Williams, it was suggested to me this morning by several people who deal with arbitrations regularly in the court that part of the reason for this act is to increase the supervision of arbitrations and the access to courts by arbitrators. I can't say that. So, like I said, I've been looking at it since this morning. I haven't had time to call many people and those sorts of things. I'm looking through the act for things that I saw. The first cost issues that were brought to me as potential cost issues were the ones concerning the duplicative process for the order and judgment and the chance for double appeals under Section 28 and the issue of lack of standard for review, because if a piece of legislation provides for review, and in a situation like this, it's a complicated procedure with limited ability for the trial court to make a record, then the question is, what is the Court of Appeals reviewing for, and what's the standard review? Those are the things that were initially brought to me as issues to present to the committee. So, I'm here. to present them to you and say that we haven't made up our mind yet on things that cost. We will sit down and look at them, but generally things like court supervision, extra appeals, extra paperwork, those sorts of things are things that in fact cost us money.
Representative Ackerman.
Mr. Swank, isn't it true, though, that you also have to consider the net effect here, and that is for every case you successfully arbitrate, you're keeping a, you know, 80 or 90% of that case out of court, so there's a tremendous amount of savings that we have to consider in the alternative dispute resolution process. I know that in my experience in arbitration, for every hour I spend in arbitration, I'd probably have to spend at least two or three in court. And my most radical experience I had was an arbitration I completed in less than 60 minutes because we had a lot of pretrial stuff out, and we went through it very, very fast. Had I tried that case in court, it would take me 2 days with a jury.
Representative Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, I couldn't agree with you more. We have been avid supporters. We don't have a circuit court in Oregon that doesn't have an arbitration program. We don't have a circuit court in Oregon that doesn't have at least some settlement provisions. Virtually all of the courts have mediation programs of some kind, some of them one or more. We're avid supporters of alternative dispute resolutions. We allow, when courts want to adopt these kinds of programs, it's one of the things that the Chief Justice always allows them to adopt out of cycle supplementary local rules to establish. When we go with the statutory minimum time. You want to establish that in 30 days? Fine. Send us a rule. We'll sign it. You can establish a program. Alternative dispute resolution, and people argue about it, but it is, I mean, some people think that it's just paying an extra cost before you have to go to court anyway. But we have been avid supporters of it. We've worked on the programs. What I'm looking for, as I do much of when I'm before this committee, is to look for unintended consequences and unintended costs, and to try and make the legislation work as well as we can possibly make it work, because we see ourselves as working with the legislature in that capacity to make the legislation work well. So that's my job, and it's why I'm here today.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. Hearing none, colleagues, there are no further witnesses. Anyone else want to testify? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2279. And not terribly productive, but at least informative today, colleagues. Our bill production rate is down today, but we'll have to try to get it up next week. Thanks, and we'll adjourn the hearing.